For most of us, the idea of fake cigarettes and illicit trade really came to the fore during the 2020 COVID lockdowns, when even the most law-abiding South Africans found themselves looking in the strangest places for their daily fix. Since then, the conversation about illicit trade, the Financial Action Task Force craylisting of South Africa for, among others, terror funding and funny money, has become an almost daily conversation. On today's show, I'm chatting with Rohan Pike, a Commonwealth law enforcement expert on border controls, foreign bribery, trade crime, money laundering, and corruption, to compare how South Africa is doing in contrast with other countries faced with similar challenges. Thank you for taking the time to come on and chat with us. We're out here in sunny South Africa, and you're all the way down there in New Zealand. But maybe let's start by telling us a little bit about the work that you do and why New Zealand at this moment, and whether you're coming up here to South Africa anytime soon.
Okay, thanks. It's great to be here. Well, I started in the federal police in Australia, did that for 25 years with a variety of crime types. Over that time, went overseas numerous times, but sort of concentrated on fraud mainly. I did come across a tobacco job, which sort of piqued my interest in tobacco and realised how profitable it was and how many serious criminals were involved in it. But then in the last 2 years of my career, I went to the Australian Border Force, which used to be known as Customs. And there I started a team solely dedicated and focused on illicit tobacco. And the commissioner gave it a really sexy name called the Tobacco Strike Team after it expanded its remit. So I've been living off that now for some time, which I'm very grateful. So for the next 9 or 10 years since I've left the Border Force, I've just had my own consultancy, part-time on the tobacco issue, part-time on investigation. But I've got more serious on the illicit tobacco issue in the last couple of years as it's grown around the world. And I've had a significant level of despair about the Australian situation because I've been warning about... Sorry?
Despair? Why despair?
Well, I've been warning about it for a long, long time and trying to alert authorities to the looming threat that is illicit tobacco, and they hadn't really been listening to me. And now that it's got completely out of control with violence and all the rest of it that we'll get into, it's almost so far gone, and the horse has bolted, really, and it's very, very difficult to rein it in here. So I am going to be using the Australian experience in other countries around the world to try to help them prevent what's happened in Australia, and that's why I'm here in New Zealand at the moment. Obviously quite close to Australia, and they might be the next target for the criminal gangs that have taken over the Australian market.
You know, I mean, this conversation for us has really piqued our interest over a couple of conversations with different politicians, particularly in South Africa, and this is global news. We have a legacy of what's called state capture. Over the past kind of 15 years, have had very deep uncovering of so much criminality that goes so deep in with politicians and the like. And last year, we had the Financial Action Task Force actually greylist South Africa as part of a network around terror financing, around illicit trade, and we were given all sorts of things that we needed to do that our Treasury has been working on trying to get us off this grey list. And this October, there will be a site visit to see if South Africa has really made any strides in any of what was flagged for grey listing us and whether we can get off the grey list. So why we're interested in hearing a little bit more about your experience really is to understand how globally this network works and whether it can be combated and how a little country like us at the tip of Africa can really have an impact and protect itself from this kind of criminality. So that's why this conversation has become so important for us. And I'm quite interested to know your government's response, how, and non-response, as it were. What would you say are the red flags that consumers, the public, should be looking out for or listening out for to say, well, maybe I should phone a representative and talk to them about this? What are those red flags?
Well, obviously the illicit rate has taken off in Australia. So when illicit tobacco is sitting at around 10%, no one really worries a bit too much about that. The criminals aren't going to be making too much money, and things are relatively safe. But ours has now jumped over 50%, heading towards 60%. They are selling it blatantly in the streets, in out of shop fronts, which are no more than just fronts for these organised crime syndicates. And the enforcement response and regime is so poor, and the legislation is so disjointed that we have no effective way of combating that. And it goes more to, than just this topic. The public look at that and think, there's, you know, something seriously wrong with our government, that our society is in a state of decay because our streets are flooded with criminal behaviour, whereas they weren't previously. So this has come about quite quickly. Of course, the rise in illicit also means that the government's not getting the revenue that they previously were through the legal channel. So in Australia, we were 5 years ago, we were receiving $16.5 billion per year in tax revenue on tobacco, and this year it's only seven. So that's a massive drop in just 5 years, and it's heading down to a point where no one's going to be smoking legal tobacco anymore, but they're smoking just as much, and it's just been smokers move over to the illicit market. So the health objectives have been undermined, the revenue objectives are undermined, the criminals are violently fighting each other for turf war so that they can get access to this market. And that's been murder, firebombings, etc.
Oh my goodness. You say criminals violently fighting turf wars, and this is just cigarettes, even for cigarettes.
Yeah, cigarettes has been is now known as being as profitable as the hard drugs like your cocaines and your meths and so on. Criminals here can load up a container in China or in the Middle East for $250,000 and sell it for close to 8 to 10 million. So the profit margin's 1 to 40, and that type of high profit, low risk type crime has not only expanded the remit of previous tobacco criminals who've been in the market, you know, quietly working away for decades, but it's now attracted these other criminals who were doing the drug stuff, but they don't want to go to jail for that. But they've moved over to tobacco, where they know that it's very unlikely A, they'll get caught, or B, they'll go to jail because, as I say, the legislation regime is not appropriate.
Gee whiz. I mean, it's mind-boggling for me. And but cigarettes aren't legal, right? Here in South Africa, there's talk. Also, we've got a tobacco bill that's currently winding its way through our parliament system. And there's talk of increasing the age at which you are allowed to sell cigarettes to young people as well. But do those things even help? I mean, what kind of legislative, with your background in law enforcement, what kind of legislative changes can make a difference to this environment, if any?
I've got a long answer to that question.
I've got time for you.
I'm not sure how long you want me to talk on that for, but I will tell you that it's very easy. In a nutshell, it's very easy to make to prohibit things, to ban things. It's very difficult to enforce it. I know that the UK is thinking about bringing in that generational ban, but That seems to be delayed in their parliament. Here, where I am today in New Zealand, they legislated for a generational ban, but then they changed government and they repealed it, which I think is a good thing because, as an enforcement person, it's almost impossible to enforce that. Imagine, setting an age of 18 years or whatever, and in 20 years' time, a person walks into a tobacconist who's 38, and the person who's 37 next to them is not allowed to buy a tobacco. It's ridiculous, and it puts far too much burden on the retailers themselves. Whereas in England and in New Zealand, as two examples, they've already solved the issue of youth smoking. Anyway, there's hardly any youth smoking at all in these two countries. So without having to implement this sort of odious legislation, which is unenforceable, they fixed the problem anyway. It's smoking is not a thing with kids in New Zealand and England. So, and that's because they have embraced vapes and other lower risk products. But so that's one of the solutions. But of course, illicit tobacco is obviously driven by the price of excise as well. So if a government pushes up excise with an attempt to gather revenue, that's often a signal for criminal gangs to undercut them with a cheaper product from overseas, and target that same market. So that's what's happened in Australia. I dare say it's happened in South Africa, where the illicit rates are quite high. And the only way to counter that is to have a properly regulated market with a balanced excise rate.
Sure. Look, I think that there are many moving parts to this kind of conversation. And I'm wondering how much of a role you talk about gangs on the one side, but also external funding for pushing through some of these kind of changes to legislation. The kind of NGO sector, we've had a conversation before about kind of foreign funding for some of those things. Do you find that this plays a role in how governments respond or don't respond?
Absolutely. I'm not exactly sure what type of foreign funding you're referring to, but some of the ones that I know are wedded almost ideologically to a prohibition type policy. And that's attractive to some countries, and certainly the health departments of some countries. But what I've found is that health departments are not law enforcement experts. In fact, they're not law enforcement agencies at all. They have no experience, expertise, and they just don't understand the consequences of what prohibition policies create. 100 years ago, it happened in the US when they had the alcohol prohibition, and everyone knows now what happened there. It went completely pear-shaped, was unenforceable, was basically the start of crime gangs and mafia outbreak in the States. So that's what happens when you want to ban things. There are other ways to change behaviours. You've got 11 million smokers in South Africa. I would suggest that if you had, it would be unrealistic to hope and dream that those 11 million will stop smoking tomorrow. Although that's what some of the policies that you're thinking about bringing in really. That's the motivation. That's the assumption behind some of those policies. And that's just simply wrong. Whereas if you could get even half of those smokers off to safer products, less harmful products, then you're going to save thousands of lives by doing that. So I think you're giving up the good for striving for the perfect.
South Africa very famously was among the first countries that pushed all of this kind of no smoking indoors and clubs and separate and I think this is possibly one of the places where, because they were so successful, the Department of Health, which was driven by Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma at the time, is probably one of the ways that they're thinking this is just a re creation, but times have changed. And I think that, sorry, say that again.
Yes, no, I agree entirely. Times have changed. So whereas some of those policies were appropriate, perhaps 10 years ago, 15 years ago, some of those levers that health departments have relied on, particularly excise, are no longer fit for purpose in the modern day, and perhaps they've been pulled too far for the detriment, and now they're causing harm in themselves by allowing an illicit market to come in underneath, which then makes smokers stick with the product instead of transitioning away from it. It also attracts kids and youth back to smoking who perhaps would have moved away naturally. But when it's so cheap, in Australia, the legal price of cigarettes is $50. You can get the illicit product for 10. And $10 is now attractive for kids to come back to smoking. So, and we've seen kids smoking rates rise, which is an absolute disaster.
Sure. And it being one of the things that we also have that happens here in South Africa is because of the price point, you're talking about the $50 versus the $10. Because of the price point, we also have lots of informal traders here in South Africa who, instead of selling a full pack, will open the pack and sell the cigarettes as, individual straws or singles, as
Sticks.
the called sticks. That's the correct term. Sell it as a loose draw, which is what we call it here in South Africa. And even that, is open to exploitation because without a pack, you also don't know what exactly it is that you're buying and opens up even more the space of illicit trade. Do you find that there's something similar that happens in other places in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every country has its own traditions on how it sells. There are other countries that sell it in individual sticks. But obviously, that undercuts health warnings, quality assurance of the product, a whole range of things. But again, part of that is price driven. So people can't afford the whole pack, so they'll want to split it up. But I would suggest, like here in New Zealand, where a legal pack of cigarettes is 40, an illicit pack is about 18. They've got vapes being sold legally for $10 because there's no excise on the vapes. So New Zealand government has taken the position, as has the UK government, that vapes are much safer than normal cigarettes. It's the difference between combustion and non-combustible products. And they encourage people through a price point without taxing it onto that. And they've had tremendous success, and their smoking rate has plummeted down to about 6%. So they're on the threshold of getting the smoke-free status along with Sweden.
Wow. So I mean, talking about Australia and New Zealand, and contrasting some of that with South Africa, maybe a little bit of a stretch, right? Because those are first world countries as compared to who we are here in
Yeah.
South Africa, but you also have
First,
experience in.
you would think so, and when that's the reputation, but our enforcement response has been third world, in fact, probably fourth world if there is such a thing. It's been very, very poor, and even though our tobacco policy has clearly failed in Australia, the government won't change tack. In fact, they're doubling down on some of the mistakes they've made, like ramping up the excise. Even last week, Australia put up the excise another 7%. So again, making a huge gap between the legal and the illegal price, and just attracting more criminals into that market. So
But you also have experience in other countries, in Pakistan and Papua New Guinea, and which are a little bit closer to our kind of markets. Any lessons from that that you think South Africa could learn from?
The lessons are that enforcement's very difficult. Once an illicit market gets a foothold, the way to get around that is to change the policies. And I would suggest that South Africa needs to understand and appreciate the difference between the combustibles, very bad, cancer-causing cigarettes. Let's dissuade that as much as make that as least as attractive as we can. But there is a better way, which is not necessarily just quitting holus bolus, because that is very, very difficult to achieve. But there are these other products which you could educate your populace to moving on to. And they should be put at a price point appropriately that would make them attractive. And you wouldn't have to go through the enforcement nightmare of running around with all sorts of inspectors and police and taking them away from other duties, the many duties that they perhaps more important, that people would move naturally to these safer products by themselves.
And just speaking about the people in particular, I like to have a conversation that also ends back with the personal responsibility. Is there any way, anything that individuals such as myself and all of our listeners, what should we be looking out for? What are the dangers and the pitfalls, and really, how do we protect ourselves from not falling into this quagmire, as it were, of illicit trade and illicit cigarettes?
It's very, very hard. On one hand, people generally want to be law-abiding, so there's a commitment to that. People like the particular brand or taste of product that they've been used to over the years. But when the product comes in that's half the price or a third of the price or even a quarter of the price, then that loyalty's stretched and tested. And in Australia, it's broken, and perhaps in quite a lot of instances in South Africa, it is too. And so that they just move. They just think that those policies from the government are then unfair, and they have no qualms about moving on to the illicit product, even knowing that their money will then be going to support some criminal syndicate and making them more powerful, and perhaps doing harm in other ways to the country at the border or corrupting other officials. But a person who wants a cigarette is going to want a product that's a quarter the price of the legal product. So I don't blame them for that. What I blame the government for is not giving those smokers the information and the education about other products and access to the other products that are out there, which will make their lives healthier and the country as a whole.
And do you find that there is a correlation between the illicit cigarette, the smugglers, the value chain, and any other kind of terror-based financing? I ask this question because Donald Trump has created a fear, I think, of in every country, in every government, of kind of blowback that says, if you're, helping finance our enemies. Do you find that these value chains cross over to each other or not?
They do. They do. I'm not an expert at it, but certainly some of the countries that I've been involved with. I've recently been to the Philippines, where they've got lots of smokers and a very difficult country to enforce because they've got 1,000 or 2,000 islands. But the lower islands are near Indonesia, where there's a significant illicit trade, and it's said that that illicit trade is funding terror outfits in the Philippines, which is obviously a major concern to them. And there has been evidence in the past that outfits in the Middle East or Syria, like ISIS, were using illicit tobacco to help fund their activities. So, and of course, criminal syndicates don't just specify tobacco as their go-to funding machine. They diversify across a range of illicit products. So it will embolden them, as I say, help corrupt officials at the border, perhaps, and that opens up windows for other illicit products to come into a country. So that's the harm that sort of illicit tobacco can do to a country.
Jeez. Very sobering conversation, and I think we've watched over the past couple of years, particularly after COVID, where here in South Africa, we had really, really, really strict laws around cigarettes and all sorts of other things during the lockdowns, which created an opportunity, I think, for that trade and that illicit market. And so this is an incredibly sobering conversation. And I kind of feel you when you started this by saying it's feeling a little down. But are there wins? Are there any wins? Are there wins anywhere else in the world?
As I say, countries who want to get ahead of this product problem, countries who want to lower the smoking rates, help the health of the country. There are examples around the world where countries have done it quite well. All of those countries, and I'll name a few, the UK, Sweden, Japan, New Zealand, have lowered their smoking rates significantly through the acceptance of lower risk nicotine products. All of them, and that's the common denominator between them all. South Africa yet to get to that point, but I think I would say that it's critical for you to understand the global science around this. So the global science is pretty clear now. I'm not a medical expert, but I can read, and I go to conferences where all this product, all this information is delivered, and it seems pretty clear to me. The other thing about, so that's a critical element, the acceptance of those products. The other element is the enforcement needs to be stricter, more serious. People need to take, you know, illicit tobacco as seriously as some of those other illicit products. So, you know, you can go to jail for a long time for a big shipment of cocaine, but what happens to a tobacco import? And not very much usually. So the legislation has to change and the penalties have to change just to create some sort of deterrence. Just on that, while South Africa have as you say, we're a leader in the FCTC, the Tobacco Convention, and promoted it rigorously and still do. There was a second convention that was formulated by the World Health Organization 10 years later, focused solely on illicit tobacco, and it's really the global template on what countries should do to protect themselves. It's called the Protocol to Eliminate Illicit Tobacco, or something close to that. Anyway, and that has a number of handy recommend. Well, it is, as I say, the global template. South Africa signed that in 2013, when it soon after it came out, but you haven't ratified it, and you certainly haven't implemented it. So, if you're looking for any ideas on how the nation should protect itself, through the enforcement response, then you only have to go to that convention and start implementing some of those things.
Wow. This has been quite an eye-opening conversation. Thank you, Rowan, for taking the time and coming on here and chatting with us and sharing your experience and sharing your knowledge with us. Thank you so much.
That's my pleasure. When I come to South Africa, I hope to see you in person.
Please do. Please do. We would love to have you here in the studio. I think this has been a highly informative conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.